Chapter 17, The Monastic Order. Corresponding to, and in the best periods largely coinciding with, the Sangha as a spiritual elite, is the Sangha as a community of men and women treading the path and striving to realize the goal by following either the Arhant or the Bodhisattva ideal. As in one form or another is the case in most organized religions, this community consists of two kinds of members: those whose experience of the path is sufficient to modify the course of their lives without radically changing it, and those who, to adopt the language of William James's definition of the religious man, though not necessarily having the most religious experience, make their experiences their center of gravity. While for the first kind, religion is only one among a multiplicity of interests, for the second, it is the supreme, even the sole interest, to which all others must be subordinated, and, if necessary, sacrificed. Thus, Buddhism, as an institutional religion, comprises both a larger body of lay followers, known as upasakas, feminine upasikas, whose practice of the Dharma is occasional and partial, and a very much smaller body of bhikshus, feminine bhikshunis, who dedicate to its realization their whole life and the sum total of their energies. The latter form the Bhikshu Sangha, the order of monks, or the monastic order, which is the primary ecclesiastical sense in which the word Sangha is now used. This order did not come into existence all at once. Like other living things, whether organisms, empires, or ideas, it has, in the course of its history, passed through various stages of development. This fact, obvious though it is from a careful study of the records, is generally ignored by writers on Buddhism. Some, indeed, would have us believe that the Sangha sprang fully formed from the brain of the Buddha, even as Pallas Athene leapt complete with shield and spear from the forehead of Zeus. Did it not command wide acceptance? A view so astonishingly naive would not be worth mentioning. In reality, the Sangha passed, during the first few generations of its existence, through three well-marked stages of development, each with certain distinctive features. 1. According to the legend of the four sites, and as other canonical sources abundantly testify, the Buddha, or the Bodhisattva as he then was, decided to seek a solution to the problem of suffering by adopting the life of the Parivrajika, or one who had gone forth, the literal meaning of the word, from life at home to be a homeless wanderer. Whether, as Sukumar Dutt suggests, and as seems probable, the Parivrajikas were originally the North-East Indian counterparts of the Brahmanas of the Aryan society to the northwest, does not concern us. It is sufficient that the Buddha, both before and after his enlightenment, was a Parivrajika, and that nearly all his closest associates were either recruited from this class or joined it in order to be with him and follow his teaching. Like Mahavira, the restorer of Jainism, and other teachers whose names are preserved in early Buddhist literature, the Buddha appeared to the general public of his times as the founder and head of one of the various sodalities into which the Parivrajika community was divided. Like other heads of sodalities, moreover, he professed and taught a special dharma, and it was this, rather than their mode of life, which distinguished him and his adherents from the rest. At this stage of its development, the Sangha was therefore simply that section of the Parivrajika community which acknowledged the Buddha as master and accepted his doctrine. As yet, there was no question of any code of monastic discipline peculiar to the followers of the Buddha. The term Vinaya, later appropriated as the collective designation of the monastic regula, which appears frequently in the well-known compound Dharma Vinaya, bore at this time the more general import of the way of life conducive to the realization of the master's teaching. The Buddha and his homeless disciples observed the unwritten traditional code of the Parivrajikas and acted according to what public opinion considered proper in those who had gone forth. They too spent the greater part of the year roaming from place to place, lived on alms, and abstained from sexual intercourse, from theft, from the taking of life, and from making false claims to supernormal attainments, the four parajikas, or defeats, of the later monastic code. Except during the 3 months of the rains, when they took shelter in a hut or cave, they too were without fixed abode. Like the members of other sects, they held a fortnightly congregational service, known as the Posada, on the full moon and new moon days, at which they recited a Pratimoksha, in Pali Pratimokkha, or verse summary of the special Dharma to which they adhered. One such Pratimoksha has been preserved in the Dhammapada, verses 184 to 186, as well as in the Mahapadana Suttanta of the Digha Nikaya. The latter attests its extreme antiquity by attributing it not to Gautama Buddha, but to Vipassana, one of his remote legendary predecessors. According to the Dhammapada, which reverses the order of the first and second stanzas, it runs, abstention from all evil, cultivation of the wholesome, purification of the heart. This is the message of the Buddhas. Forbearance is the highest ascetic practice. Nirvana is supreme, say the Buddhas. He is not a gone forth who harms another. He is not a recluse, samana, who molests another. Not to speak ill, not to injure, to observe the Pratimokkha, to be moderate in eating, to live alone in a secluded abode, to devote oneself to meditation. This is the message of the Buddhas. In the Buddha's day, it was the Dharma as embodied in such stanzas as these, and not a code of rules, that constituted the bond of union, probably the original meaning of Pratimoksha, between his followers. Similarly, the rite of Upasampada meant at that time not initiation into a monastic order fully equipped with rules and regulations, but simply the formal recognition of the Buddha as teacher and the acceptance, the literal meaning of the word, of his teaching. At first, this was considered as taking place when the Buddha uttered the words, "Come, Bhikshu." Later on, applications for admission having greatly increased, he permitted the senior disciples to receive candidates on his behalf by causing them to repeat the formula of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The body of adherents which thus grew up around him and often accompanied him as he walked from place to place was known as the Bhikshu Sangha of the Four Quarters. An invaluable glimpse of the Sangha at this stage of its existence, termed by G. F. Allen the pristine ascetic stage, is provided by the oldest portions of the Sutta Nipata, especially the Ataka and Parayana Vaggas, and by the Bhikkhu Vagga of the Dhammapada. 2. After the Parinirvana of the Buddha, his disciples found themselves confronted by a number of problems, not the least of them being that of the preservation of the Dharma Vinaya. For some, perhaps most, the proper fulfilment of this great responsibility involved not only creating from their individual recollections of what the Buddha had said and done a common stock of oral tradition, but also adopting a code of discipline, the observance of which might further differentiate them from the rest of the Parivrajika community. The drawing up of the rudiments of such a code was, perhaps, the principal item on the agenda of the First Council, which the Pali canonical texts describe as a Vinaya Sangiti. ancient Parivrajika conventions, which had received the stamp of the Buddha's approval, directives which he had himself issued from time to time, either on his own initiative or in response to public opinion, together with, in all likelihood, a few regulations thought necessary by the council itself, were collected and classified. The resultant body of rules, which was made binding on every individual bhikshu, eventually became fixed at 550 items. Since it was recited at the fortnightly congregational meetings, displacing the original Dharma stanzas, it gradually took over the designation Pratimoksha. In other words, during the second stage of its existence, the Sangha, besides continuing to possess a spiritual bond of union in the Dharma, in addition acquired an external bond of union in the form of the monastic code. This development had far-reaching consequences. From being socially indistinguishable from the other Parivrajika groups, the Sangha became an independent ecclesiastical corporation, recognizable as such to the general public. Upasampada was no longer a simple acceptance of the Buddha and his teaching. It became the ceremony of ordination into a monastic order. From a common declaration of faith, the posada was transformed into a service of confession of individual failures to observe the code. The difference between monk and layman was accentuated, being no longer merely that between those who had left and those who had not left home, but between the ordained, who observed the code, and the unordained, who did not. Yet though much was altered, much remained the same. The bhikshus were still largely eremitical, still lived on alms, and still remained in one spot during the rains. 3. The third stage of development arose out of a change more radical than any that had previously taken place. During the Buddha's lifetime, even, parks and gardens had been donated to the Sangha, with provision for accommodation during the rains. These were certainly not monasteries in the modern sense, and whether in art or in literature, or merely in one's own imagination, it is a grave anachronism to depict Anatta Pindika or Bimbisara as putting up large and complex structures of brick and stone. Scattered up and down the donated area, known as the Avasa, were a number of lodgings or viharas in the form of wattle and daub huts, such as can be seen all over India even today. A bhikshu had the right of occupying one of these lodgings during the rains. When the rains were over, he continued his wanderings. Later on, it became possible to reserve the lodging one had just vacated, and thus to spend a number of rainy seasons consecutively in one vihara, as the Buddha himself had done at Shravasti. In this stage of development that had now been reached, the Sangha took the revolutionary step of abandoning the Parivrajika tradition of a wandering life in favour of permanent residence at an avasa. The reasons for this transition from the eremitic to the cenobitic type of religious life are obscure. They are probably bound up with the growth of the monastic code and with the need for collating the floating mass of oral tradition existing in the memories of hundreds of reciters. Be the reasons for it what they may, the change modified the constitution of the Sangha to an unprecedented degree. The Sangha of the Four Quarters was replaced, for all practical purposes, by the local Sangha resident at a particular avasa. As the Pratimoksha, or monastic code, was unable to cover all the exigencies of the more complex type of communal life that now rapidly developed, it was in practice supplemented, and to some extent superseded by, the Skandhikas, or the Chapters, a series of elaborate treatises on such subjects as medicine, robes, ordination, and schism. This led to another change in the posada. From a confessional, it became a liturgical service, at which the Pratimoksha was solemnly recited, not, as before, in order that erring monks might confess and atone for their transgressions, but simply as a formal expression of the unity and solidarity of the local Cenobitical Sangha. Similarly, Upasampada now meant ordination, not so much into the Sangha of the four quarters governed by the Pratimoksha, as into the resident Sangha of a particular Avasa, living in accordance with what, by yet another appropriation of an ancient term, came to be known as the Vinaya. Moreover, as it settled down in the Avasas, the Sangha naturally became more accessible to the laity. Donations therefore poured in, and endowments multiplied. Eventually, though some remained faithful to the old tradition, it was no longer necessary for the monks to go out and beg their food from door to door. Exactly how long it took for the characteristic features of each of these stages to emerge is not clear. The Sangha of the third stage, which was responsible for compiling the extant biographical cum disciplinary traditions into a Vinaya Pitaka, or rather Pitakas, there were several versions, being anxious to father their distinctive innovations upon the master himself, telescoped them into a period coeval with that of his pastoral activity, and manufactured, as part of his biography, incidents and episodes out of which they were supposed to have risen. These legends, in the sense of fictions, which were incorporated into the Vinaya Pitaka, cannot stand up to critical examination. The entire process of development from primitive eremitical to sophisticated cenobitical monasticism must in fact have taken at least a century, so that we may safely conclude that, probably by the time of the Second Council, the Council of Vaishali, and certainly that of Ashoka's accession to the throne of Magadha, it was complete. Whether earlier by a few decades or later, though, the fact that such a process had taken place does not mean, nor in the history of Buddhism ever meant, that a later stage of development supplanted, in the sense of ousting and wholly superseding, an earlier one. As with the doctrine, so with the discipline, in the widest sense of the term Vinaya, development almost invariably took place by way of a process of gradual accretion and elaboration, rather than by one of summary rejection and reform. The second stage of the process overlaid, without being entirely able to conceal, the first, and was in turn its turn overlaid, but not concealed, by the third. The second stage of the process overlaid, without being able entirely to conceal the first, and was in its turn overlaid, but not concealed by the third. Thus, from the beginning of the third period, the individual bhikshu, or member of the Sangha, grew up under the influence of, and was confronted by, three different, not to say contradictory, ideals of monastic life. He was simultaneously exhorted to wander alone, even as the horn of the rhinoceros is single, the refrain from an early ballad, without caring for rules and regulations, to observe scrupulously the 150 clauses of the individualistic monastic code, and to participate in, even identify himself with, the complex corporate life of a permanently resident monastic community. These discrepancies did not escape the notice of the Indo-Bactrian king Milinda, or Menander, who, with a critical acumen quite modern, quoted verses pertaining respectively to the earlier eremitical and the later cenobitical stage, and propounded the obvious contrast of ideals to Nagasena as his 41st dilemma. In the life of the Sangha, their conflicting demands naturally generated a certain amount of tension. However, as it was believed that the Buddha himself had, at different periods, sanctioned both ideals, the latter admittedly by way of concession to the weaker brethren, the tension between them never became a disruptive influence. The doctrine of concessions finds classic expression in that part of the Upasampada ceremony, where, having been exhorted to subsist on alms, wear robes made from cast-off rags, live at the foot of a tree and use cow's urine for medicine. The four nisayas or supports. The newly ordained bhikshu was informed that accepting invitations from the laity, wearing robes offered by them, dwelling in viharas, and having recourse to ordinary medical treatment were also permissible. This in effect meant that he was free to follow the eremitical or the cenobitical ideal, or a compromise between the two, according to his individual temperaments and convictions. Nevertheless, owing not only to human weakness, but to the necessity of preserving and transmitting enormous bodies of traditionary lore, as well as to the fact that much of this was compiled and edited under cenobitical auspices, it was the cenobitical type of monasticism that triumphed. In its fully developed form, it eventually reached its apogee in such great institutions as the Mahavihara, Nalanda, and Drepung, and even today constitutes, in most parts of the Buddhist world, the normal working basis, though not necessarily the sole theoretic ideal, of the monastic order. Before describing the life of a bhikshu under the dominant cenobitical system, we shall have to guard against a possible grave misunderstanding. We have already seen that the whole course of development of the Sangha, with its three clearly marked stages, was probably complete by the time of the Second Council, the Council of Vaishali. Now, it was in connection with this council, held 100 or 110 years after the Parinirvana, that there occurred the first great schism in the Sangha, that between the conservative minority, known as the Staviravadins, and the progressive majority, known as the Mahasanghikas. This means that the development of cenobitical monasticism preceded the rise of the Mahayana, which, as a distinct historical movement, originated among the Mahasanghikas. The point is important and significant, because in recent times, certain uninformed followers of the Theravada, an offshoot of the original Staviravada, have accused the Mahayanists of having no Vinaya, no Upasampada lineage, and therefore no bhikshus or bhikshunis, and no real monastic order. In the case of the Chinese, Tibetan, Korean, and Vietnamese adherents of the Mahayana, the accusation is completely unfounded. Far from rejecting any of them, the Mahayana took up and incorporated in its own movement the whole stock of primitive traditions, including the monastic code and Upasampada lineage, as transmitted by the Mahasanghika, the Savastivada, and other early schools. For historical reasons, there have survived in the Buddhist world only two of the ancient traditions of cenobitical monasticism, the Theravada and the Savastivada. The former is transmitted with Pali for its literary medium in the Theravadin countries of Southeast Asia. The latter, the medium of which was originally Sanskrit, in China, Japan, Tibet, Korea, and Vietnam, and other parts of the Mahayana world in the languages of those countries. Despite minor discrepancies between these two great traditions, in regard to both material included and the manner of its arrangement, there can be no doubt that their respective versions of the monastic code and the chapters, at least, represent different recensions of one and the same basic material. Both the Theravadin monks of Sri Lanka and the Mahayana, strictly Savastivadin, monks of Tibet, for example, are the true lineal descendants of the original cenobitical monastic order, which came into existence during the third stage of development of the early Sangha. As it has the same spiritual orientation and is based upon what are substantially the same Vinaya traditions, the pattern of monasticism naturally varies little from one part of the Buddhist world to another. This fact makes possible an account of the monastic life, which, ignoring variations due to differences of national culture, directs attention to its main features. The bhikshu's life begins with ordination. This is of two kinds, known respectively as Pravrajya and Upasampada. The former, which may be taken as soon as one is old enough to earn a living by scaring crows, that is to say, at any time after the age of 7 or 8, consists in shaving hair and beard, donning the saffron robes, and taking from an upadhyaya, or preceptor, the three refuges, tri sharana, in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and the 10 precepts, dasa, shikshapada, to abstain from injury to living beings, from taking what has not been given, from unchastity, from wrong speech, from intoxicating drinks and drugs, the 5 precepts of the Upasaka, except that unchastity here replaces sexual misconduct, from untimely meals, from dance, song, music, and unseemly shows, from the use of garlands, perfumes, unguents, and things that tend to beautify and adorn the person, from lofty and luxurious seats, and from handling gold and silver. The latter may be conferred on any virile male human being who has attained the age of 20, reckoning from conception, not birth, whose begging bowl and 3 monastic robes are complete, who has obtained the permission of his parents if living, and who is, moreover, is free from serious disease, from civil obligations, and from various other disqualifications. Unlike its orthodox Hindu counterparts, known as sannyasa, which traditionally is open only to those who are Brahmins by birth, the Upasampada is given without any restriction of caste, nationality, race, or social position, an attitude of typical Buddhist universality, to which the practice of the Siyama Nikaya of Sri Lanka constitutes a unique and most regrettable exception. The actual ordination is effected by means of what is known as a Sanghakarma, a corporate official act of the Sangha, consisting, in this case, in the unanimous passing of a formal resolution, Nyapti, by the entire Sangha resident at a particular avasa, and assembled for the purpose, the number of such bhikshus being not less than 5, or 10 in the so-called middle country, all of whom must be exempt from certain technical disabilities. Having been interrogated regarding his freedom from the disqualifications by one of the bhikshus, known in the Sanskrit tradition as the Rahonu Sasaka Bhikshu, or Privy Admonisher, not the monk who imparts the esoteric teaching, the candidate for ordination is brought within the circle of the Sangha, where, after saluting the bhikshus one by one in order of seniority, he petitions the Sangha for ordination with a certain elder, whom he names, and who generally is the senior-most bhikshu present, as his preceptor, Upadhyaya. Then, in the presence of the Sangha, he is formally interrogated regarding the disabilities by the Karmakaraka bhikshu, or master of ceremonies. Finally, the subject matter of the proceedings, namely that the candidate, being a virile male and so on, desires ordination from the Sangha with the elder named as his preceptor, is embodied in a formal resolution, Nyapti, which, after being proposed to the assembly by the master of ceremonies, is repeated 3 times in the form of a declaration, Karmavachana. If the bhikshus remain silent, the resolution is taken as passed, and the master of ceremonies announces that the Upasampada has been granted. After the date and exact time of the candidate's formal admission to the Sangha have been ascertained, various monastic obligations are taught and explained. In particular, he is informed of the 4 nishrayas, or supports, and the various concessions allowed with regard to them, and of the 4 pataniya dharmas, or things bringing about downfall. The latter are identical with the 4 parajikas, or defeats. The remaining sets of obligations need not be taught immediately after the formal ceremony. They comprise the 4 Shramana Karaka Dharmas, or duties of an ascetic, the 150 prohibitions of the monastic code, and various duties which the newly ordained monk has to perform towards his upadhyaya. The first set embodies the principle of non-retaliation. Even when others revile or become angry with or beat or upbraid him, the shramana must refrain from acting in like manner. The 150 shilas of the pratimoksha or monastic code are divided according to the nature of the penalties incurred by their descending order from the graver to the lighter offences. These all concern the conduct of the individual bhikshu. A seventh category, which is binding upon the Sangha collectively, consists of rules for the settlement of internal disputes at an avasa. According to the nature of the penalties involved, these seven categories of offences are known as 1. Parajika, or defeat, permanent expulsion from the Sangha without possibility of readmission in the present lifetime. 2. Sangha Varsesa, or temporary suspension from full membership of the Sangha. 3. Aniyata, or undetermined, an offence of one or another type having been committed or not committed according to circumstances. 4. Naisargika Patayantika, or forfeiture and expiation, when the possession of a prohibited article is acknowledged as a fault and the article surrendered. 5. Patayantika, or prayaschitya, or expiation by a simple acknowledgement. 6. Pratideshanya, or confession. And 7. Adi Karana Samata, or rules of procedure for the settlement of disputes within the Sangha. As might be anticipated, the four so-called defeats are identical in all Vinaya traditions. The seven categories are also common to the Theravada and the various branches of the Sarvastivada. Excluding the Aniyata and the Adi Karana Samata, many differences do, however, exist with regard to the number of offences included in a category, the nature and wording of the offences, and the order of their arrangement. The Sarvastivada, for instance, gives the number of the Patayantika rules as 90, whereas, according to the Theravada, there are 92. Nevertheless, such differences, though not to be overlooked, are so much less numerous and striking than the resemblances that the predominant impression remains one of uniformity. Nalinaksha Dutt, the editor of the Gilgit manuscripts, indeed states categorically that, quote, "substantially the Pali and Sanskrit versions agree, not only in the main contents, but also in details, and sometimes one version appears to be based on the other." It is curious, though, that while the Sarvastivadins and their branch, the Mula Sarvastivadins, both managed to preserve 150 Pratimoksha rules, the Theravada, while retaining the traditional number for the total, has actually transmitted 152, a fact for which there appears to be no explanation. All Vinaya traditions also transmit, in addition to the monastic code proper, a list of saiksa rules which differ from the pratimoksha in being binding on both bhikshu and shramanera. As they are concerned with matters of etiquette, decorum and good manners, rather than with ethics or discipline, no penalty is attached to their infringement. The Sarvastivadins transmit 113 such rules, the Mula Sarvastivadins 108 and the Theravadins 75. Adding the 150 prohibitions of the Pratimoksha, 152 for the Theravada, to their respective lists of saiksa rules, we arrive at the grand total of rules transmitted by each of these schools in their individual versions of the full monastic code for bhikshus, namely 263, 258 and 227 respectively. Bhikshunis observe a much larger number of rules, 371 in the Mula Savastivada and 311 in the Theravada. Except that there are no aniyata or undetermined rules, these are distributed into the same categories as those governing the bhikshu. The Theravadin bhikshuni lineage, though extinct in the Theravadin countries, is said to have survived in China. The relation between the Upadhyaya and his Sadiviharika, or co-resident, as the newly ordained monk is called, is essentially that of father and son, transposed to the spiritual plane. Besides learning from him, the Sadiviharika is expected to render the Upadhyaya all manner of personal service, and upon each is incumbent for life the duty of nursing the other when sick. Without the permission of the Upadhyaya, the Sadiviharika may do nothing. This condition of spiritual tutelage is known as Nishraya, literally dependence on a teacher, and it lasts for a minimum of 5, usually for 10 years, during which period the Sadiviharika resides permanently with the preceptor. A dull or undisciplined bhikshu may be kept under such tutelage all his life. Probably because the senior-most elder of an avasa is often obliged to ordain more disciples than one person can train, an acharya, or instructor, is also appointed. The relation between the acharya and his antivasika, as the young monk is termed in relation to him, is identical with that between upadhyaya and sadiviharika. Nevertheless, the upadhyaya enjoys a certain precedence, for whenever all three happen to be together, nishraya towards the acharya automatically ceases. It is, though, the acharya who, under the upadhyaya, is responsible for the day-to-day teaching and training of the newly ordained monk. Only those monks who are richly endowed with various ethical and spiritual qualities, and who have completed 10 years in the Sangha, are considered fit to ordain and teach others. They should be deeply learned, with a natural understanding of educational psychology, and capable not only of instructing the disciple, but skilled in resolving his doubts and dispelling the moods of depression to which he may be subject during the training. They must be able to nurse him should he fall ill. The relation between master and disciple is the axle upon which turns the entire monastic system. Some bhikshus, out of devotion and a desire to learn, remain with their tutor for some years after the cessation of formal nishraya, or even attend permanently upon him until his death. In the early days of Buddhism, when the Dharma Vinaya was transmitted orally, much time was spent in learning the words of the sacred tradition by heart, and reciting them in unison. As it was of vast extent, and constantly expanding, the tradition soon transcended the powers of all save a few prodigies of mnemonic capacity. Specialization was therefore became the rule. Individual monk reciters learned, and in turn passed on to their own disciples, not the whole Dharma Vinaya as handed down at a particular avasa or group of avasas, but only a section of it. Sutrantikas transmitted the sutras, Vinayadharas the Vinaya, and so on. They also explained and commented upon what was transmitted, thus building up a secondary tradition of exegesis, which could easily become confused with the primary one. This is particularly the case with the Abhidharma, which was elaborated out of the matrikas or matrices transmitted by the matrikadharas, and finally came to be regarded, in some circles at least, as canonical. When the sacred tradition was committed to writing, probably in the 4th century after the Parinirvana, all this was changed. Though learning by heart continued to be a highly respectable occupation for a monk, and enjoyed great prestige long after its utility had been exhausted, the emphasis eventually shifted from reciting to reading. The oral became a literary tradition. At the same time, the curriculum of monastic studies broadened. time was devoted not only to the scriptures, commentaries, and independent expository texts, but ancillary subjects such as grammar, rhetoric, and prosody. Quasi-religious subjects, ranging from ecclesiastical history to logic and dialectics, and from medicine to various branches of the fine and applied arts, were also introduced. Secular literature was cultivated, and non-Buddhist religious and philosophical texts critically studied. Like their later European counterparts, the monasteries came to be not only centres of spiritual life and religious activity, but repositories of all the learning and culture of the age. This naturally encouraged further specialisation. Each acharya, on the basis of a sound knowledge of the scriptures, took up a single subject or group of subjects. Once this stage had been reached, there was nothing left for the cenobitical monastic system to do but to evolve, out of the very perfection of its development, its own antithesis. The best acharyas were not always available all under the same roof. In some parts of the Buddhist world, therefore, part of the novitiate became a kind of vandayaya, with the young monk begging his way from one monastic centre to another, and sitting for a season at the feet, now of one, now of another, great specialist in Buddhistic lore, until his monastic education was complete. Xuang Sang's pilgrimage to India partly conforms to this pattern, which in China itself seems to have been a popular one. Every member of the Sangha possessed, as such, certain inherent rights. These the young monk learned to exercise, not only by studying the Vinaya, but by participating in the communal religious life of the avasa to which he belonged. For instance, his personal property was limited to certain articles, known as the Asta Pariskara, or eight requisites, the three robes, the begging bowl, a razor, a needle, the girdle, and a water strainer. All other property, whether lands, buildings, or furniture, was vested in the Sangha. That is to say, it belonged, even when nominally dedicated to the Bhikshu Sangha of the Four Quarters, to the monks resident at an avasa in their collective capacity. This property the individual Bhikshu was entitled to utilize. The most important right he possessed, however, was that of participating in all corporate official acts of the Sangha. Without his presence or his formal consent to the proceedings, if unable to attend, no such act was valid. As Sukumar Dutt insists, the right of direct participation in the Sangha Kama inheres in each duly qualified member of an avasa and is very jealously guarded. This right conferred upon the Sangha a strictly republican character. Though the minimum number of bhikshus required for a particular type of corporate official act varied from 4 to 20, an act would not be valid if carried out by them alone, without the participation of all the other bhikshus who at the time happened to be resident at the avasa. In other words, every assembly of the Sangha had to be complete in respect of the avasa concerned. Among the more important corporate acts of the Sangha, apart from the Upasampada, were the Posada, the Vasavasa, the Pravarana, and the Katina, all of which occurred, or recurred, at fixed points in the ecclesiastical year. In its original form, the Posada was a full moon and new moon day observance common to all the Parivrajika communities, its introduction into Buddhism being due to the suggestion of certain lay devotees. As an institution of cenobitical monasticism, it consisted in the solemn ceremonial recitation of the monastic code. Sometimes the entire code was recited, sometimes only the more serious offences. In either case, at this stage of the development of the Sangha, infringements were no longer confessed in the course of the actual recital. Instead, the participating bhikshus made mutual confession in pairs beforehand. This preliminary ceremony, known as parishuddhi, purification, ultimately became as much a formality as the ceremony it preceded. The three remaining Sangha Karmas occurred only once a year. In the rhythm of the old eremitic monastic life, the Vasavasa, or Rain's Residence, naturally occupied a place of the highest importance. But as the Sangha gradually settled down into permanent residence at the Avasas that had served in the earliest days of its existence, merely as temporary shelters from the torrential monsoon rains, the institution lost much of its original significance. For the majority of bhikshus, the only difference between this period and the remaining 8 or 9 months of the year was that during the one they might not and did not travel, while during the other they might but did not. Nevertheless, formal observance of the institution continued, and a monk's seniority was still reckoned according to the number of Rain's residences he had observed since ordination. Countries where there were no seasonal rains could not observe the Rain's residence even as a formality. In some parts of the Buddhist world, such as China, it therefore became a summer residence. Eventually, the residence developed into a kind of spiritual retreat, for the duration of which the monks observed the Vinaya more strictly than usual and devoted themselves to intensive study, teaching, and meditation. In this form, the institution lives on in almost all Buddhist lands and possesses enormous value. The Pravarana, which marked the conclusion of the Vasavasa, was generally held on the 14th or 15th day of Kartika, October-November, that is to say, on the full moon day of that month or the day after. On this occasion, the bhikshus, having observed the Rain's residence together, assembled to give, quote, satisfaction, the literal meaning of the term, to one another by inviting inquiry as to their conduct during this period, confessing their transgressions, and mutually asking forgiveness for any fault committed. The katina, or difficult ceremony, was that of the distribution among the monks who had completed the Vasavasa of the robes and robe material offered on the occasion by the laity. It received its designation from the hardship originally suffered by the eremitic monks, who, at the official conclusion of the residence, which did not always coincide with the end of the actual monsoon, had to resume their travels without sufficient protection from the weather. In addition to these, the Sangha performed, as circumstances required, a variety of other acts. It might have to try a case of alleged breach of the monastic code, and if the accused was found guilty, impose on him the prescribed penalty, or appoint the various offices necessary for the running of a large cenobitic establishment, dedicate a building or part of a building for any special purpose, settle the boundary of Anavasa, or determine the succession to the personal belongings of a deceased bhikshu. In all these proceedings, every monk of good standing had the right and the duty of full participation. The practice of meditation also was not forgotten. In the earliest days of the Sangha, during the lifetime of the Buddha and immediately after, the best part of a monk's time was spent in this manner. Such portions of the scriptures as reflect the life of this period describe how, having returned from the alms round and rested a while after eating, the monk passed the remainder of the day under a tree absorbed in dhyana, sometimes practicing until far into the night. According to the Tibetan version of the Vinaya Vastu of the Mula Savastivadins, the Buddha introduced the practice of meditation and the observance of the posada simultaneously, which suggests a special connection between them. The prologue to the Pali Samanyapala Sutta, Digha Nikaya 2, relates that when one beautiful full moon night in autumn, Jivaka the physician escorted Ajatasattu on a visit to the Blessed One, and they found him and 1,200 disciples sitting together in absolute silence. On another Uposatha day, when the monks had been meditating half the night, the Buddha held up the proceedings for several hours, until an impure monk, who had failed to leave of his own accord, had been ejected by Moggallana. Only when the assembly was pure did he allow the Patimokkha to be recited. If it represents the general practice of the Sangha at that time, this incident shows the Posada observance originally consisted of two parts, group meditation and the recitation of the Dharma stanzas. As the cenobitic system developed, however, the practice of meditation declined. The necessity of transmitting the Dharma Vinaya took precedence, for the time being, over all other duties. The chapters, in its several versions, draws a picture of monastic life devoted almost exclusively to study, recitation, and doctrinal discussion. The first part of the Posada observance, namely the group meditation, was abolished, possibly at the same time that the second part became a recitation of the monastic code. Xuan Zang, describing the glories of 7th century Nalanda, has much to say about lectures, studies, and general academic routine, but he is strangely silent regarding meditation. We are not to infer, of course, that so vitally important a subject was ever totally neglected. Every monk certainly learned the theory of meditation and acquired the rudiments of the practice of one or another of the various methods in vogue. All the same, there prevailed, from an early period, the feeling that study and meditation were incompatible, and that one could be wholeheartedly prosecuted only at the expense of the other. Buddhaghosa, in the Visuddhimagga, says of books that, for one who is constantly busy with recitations, etc., they are an impediment to samadhi. Having students to instruct is another impediment. The same author's enumeration of the 18 faults of a monastery indeed suggests that the busy life of any large cenobitic establishment is in itself unfavourable to meditation. A division of labour, as it were, therefore became the rule. One group of bhikshus devoted itself to study, the other to meditation. In India, the first group seems to have predominated, though the evidence on which an impression is based, being itself literary, is not really conclusive. In any case, a movement known as the Yogacara, devoted, as its name suggests, to the practice of meditation, eventually sprang up and gained many adherents. In China and Japan, and to a lesser extent Tibet, where the meditative tradition flourished in the form of independent schools, saw the rise of a new type of cenobitical monasticism, organized in accordance with the special requirements not of the life of study, but the life of meditation. And all over the Buddhist world, in every age, a few meditating monks remained aloof from every form of organized monasticism, preferring to dwell alone, like their predecessors of old, in dense forests and remote mountain caves.